Now, what we're going to be practicing is a method that I learnt in Thailand many years ago from my teacher Ajahn Mahachachai. And he teaches metta meditation in a way that is very methodical, very careful, and like a meaningful approach to developing metta. When we talk about doing metta or loving kindness, it's very easy to talk about it as a nice emotion or a nice thing that people should feel. And we have this kind of idea, yes, of course, everybody should love each other. Yes, nobody should hate each other. That's great. And the world is full of people who say that and then go out and support wars and killing and do all of these terrible things. Yeah. And so there's this disconnect between what we think, what our idea is, and what the reality is. So one of the purposes of metta meditation is to overcome that disjunct, because we all have that same thing. We all presumably think it's good to love and good to be kind, and yet sometimes we don't love, and sometimes we are not kind. And so we have that same disjunct inside ourselves. So the practice of metta meditation aims to develop our mind and our heart in such a way that that feeling of metta that we exalt as one of the most sublime of human potentials becomes realized within our own heart. And this is one of the astonishing and transformative features of this meditation. And you begin to realize when it starts to spark and when it starts to happen, you begin to realize that that love that they speak about, that transcendent love that all the sages speak about, that love that people for thousands of years have said, this is God, this is divinity, this is transcendence. And then you realize that that is inside you. And that same potential is inside you, and it has been all along. And when you get in touch with that in your meditation, you will have a feeling like coming home. Like you found something in yourself that you always kind of knew was there, but didn't quite see. You feared that it wasn't there. Yeah, you feared that it wasn't there. You wonder, is that for me? Some of you are probably thinking that right now. You're probably thinking, oh, that's all right for some, but not for me. But I'm here to tell you it is for you. And it is for every single one of you. And we all have that metta inside ourselves. When the Buddha spoke about this meditation, he called it metta bhavana. This Pali word, metta meaning loving kindness, is the universal wish for the happiness of oneself and for all beings. Bhavana is a word we usually translate as meditation. But the literal meaning of the word bhavana is from the root bhu, to be, and bhavana is a causative form. What it means literally is to make it be more. Yeah? To make it be more, to grow it, to amplify it, to cultivate it. And so we are not magicking metta into existence. It already is. We are growing it, what is inside you already. So each human being, I believe, each human being has the potential to experience metta. And the metta meditation is a way of helping us to get in contact with that and to cultivate it so that it is not something that is just fleeting. It's not like, as Dolly Parton said, a butterfly that flits in and out of our life without us knowing how or why it comes. But it is something which is inherent to who we are and which we realize is actually perfectly normal and natural. Now, this meditation is very personal. It's very vulnerable. And one of the things that you might find as you're doing the meditation is that despite everything that I might say and everything that the Buddha might say, you can't find any love in your own heart. And you might be sitting there day after day meditating and thinking, oh no, they promised me that I had love in my heart, but it's not there. I must be the exception. I must be the one who doesn't have it. Don't worry, it doesn't work like that. Yeah. The way that we personally respond to the meditation is very individual. Okay? Some people will start the meditation and straight away they'll feel this strong feelings of joy and love overwhelming them. Other people may be practiced for a long time and still not feel anything. It's okay, just be patient, all right? Maybe this isn't the meditation for you. Maybe some other practice would be better. But at least for this retreat, we'll try it and we'll see. The funny thing is that one of the things that I've noticed is that it's often not the people that you think who necessarily are the ones who are going to get the best results in metta meditation. People who seem very loving and very kind, they come and they do the meditation, they're like, oh, there's nothing there. Whereas on the other hand, somebody who maybe feels very gruff or a bit angry, they have a great meditation. Yeah. Your mind is funny. Don't worry about it too much. All we can do is undertake that practice, and we have some faith. And for many of us, I hope, for many of us, or hopefully for all of us, we will be able to see at least something of that metta inside ourselves. All right, so let's talk about the meditation method, and I'll talk about the first steps of the method today, and we'll do some guided meditation, and then each day we'll do a little bit more, okay? All right. So the way that Ajahn Chah Chai teaches metta meditation, we begin by developing metta for four people when we do each one in turn, and this is a method which is from the ancient Theravada meditation manual, the Visuddhimagga. If you were to look up the canonical source for it, or the scriptural source. Visuddhimagga actually has an excellent section on metta and on different ways of getting rid of anger. So if you're doing this meditation and you feel yourself getting angry or having angry thoughts or something like that, then you can get hold of a copy of the Visuddhimagga. It's translated in English as The Path of Purification, and it has a whole list, page after page, of different methods of getting rid of anger. And I can guarantee you that by the time you've made it to the end, you will have forgotten what you were angry about. It's excellent. Okay, so the beginning of this meditation is metta for oneself. Okay, now if we don't have metta for ourselves, then how do we have metta for others? Yeah. The culmination of metta, the perfection of metta, is loving kindness for all sentient beings. Yeah, and you are a sentient being. You are one of them, and you are no less deserving of love than any other, no less deserving of happiness. And you might look into your own soul and think, oh my goodness, it is full of rot and filth and corruption and pollution. And you may be right, maybe that is how your soul is, but that is irrelevant. That doesn't matter. You are still just as deserving of being happy, just as deserving of love. And if it is true, even if it is true, that our soul is filled with rot and filth, I don't really believe that's true, but let's just say that that is true, then how are we to begin to lift ourselves above that without the redemptive power of love? If we cannot love ourselves, how can we begin our path? How can we rise above our situation? So we begin by doing metta for ourselves. Let's run briefly through the occasions in the day when you have metta for yourself. Okay, when you are hungry, you eat. When you are thirsty, you drink. When you are tired, you sleep. Our day is filled with acts of kindness to ourselves. And yet somehow we often don't notice that. Yeah? Or we even undermine that. Yeah? And we know that there are various kinds of twistedness in our mind that can cause us to harm ourselves. But for the most part, we actually do act in a way to care for ourselves and to love for ourselves. So that feeling is there. Now, there are some people who say that, who try to say that loving oneself is culturally determined. And they say that Asian people learn to love themselves and Western people learn to hate themselves. And this is something that you hear quite a lot in Buddhist circles. I don't believe it like at all. I've heard this repeated so many times by people, and I think it's racist and dumb, and I don't care what teachers are repeating it. I've been teaching metta meditation for 20-something years, and my experience through listening to countless interviews and talking to people and developing it is that everybody is different, and that to make these kinds of cultural generalizations is really, to my mind, very foolish and kind of misses the point. I only mention this because if you're reading around in Buddhism, you're likely to find things like this. It's repeated endlessly. And anyway, don't worry about any of that. Your job is to find that love inside yourself. If you need to begin, then just reflect, as I've been talking, on those small things that you do to show that love for yourself. Coming on this retreat, that's a good one. Yeah? You decided to give yourself the time and the space to come on retreat, to heal your heart, to elevate your consciousness. What is that, if not a magnificent gesture of love for yourself? I'm speaking to a few people in the interviews, and there's a few people who've been sponsored to come on the retreat by their partners, which is really amazing. I think that's really incredible. The lengths that people will go to get their partner out of the house for a week. No, that's not what I meant. I'm purely joking. But that's real love, isn't it? Yeah, that's real love. Looking after each other at that deep level. Yeah. So when we begin this meditation, first of all, we want to clarify the fact that we do in fact have that love for ourselves. And if we need to remind ourselves of that, then remind yourself. And then when we begin the meditation, how the meditation goes is something like this. Yesterday we talked about the mindful awareness meditation, and we learned about the time, the place, the posture, and sitting down with a purpose in your mind to do the meditation, and we were doing the mindful awareness. So that all stays exactly the same, right? And we begin with a few minutes of mindful awareness at the start of the meditation. Now remember yesterday I also said don't mix and match your meditations, by which I mean don't like drift from one to the other or just throw them in randomly because you feel like it. But it's okay to do a meditation if it's designed in such a way that that the different parts of the meditation can have different approaches during that. So it's the same with metta meditation. We begin with a few minutes of mindful awareness, and that centers and grounds us in the present and in our body. And in particular, it alerts us to if we have any feelings that are on that side of negativity and anger. Right? If you have any thoughts of grudge or vengeance or any of those negative kinds of feelings, we want to be aware of that before starting the metta meditation. Now, if those feelings are strong, yeah, don't do the metta meditation. Okay? Why? Because it's like putting paint on a dirty wall. It's just going to like slop over the top and then crack off. So just be patient. if you need to deal with a strong feeling of anger or irritation or something, then just deal with that feeling, do some walking meditation until you feel okay, and then come back and start again. If it's just a little bit, then never mind. This is something that you will learn as you go, right? So we check it out, our own mind, our own heart. We know when we're ready to practice, and then we begin, may I be happy. And so we say to ourselves the words, may I be happy. And we say those words continually on and on and on. And those words, which will develop and grow, they will change a little bit through the meditation, but those words are our friend and our support during the meditation. Okay? When we say those words, my teacher, who's a Thai monk, he said, say it to yourself, and I quote, like Shakespeare. I'm not exactly sure what he meant by that. Mayest thou be happy, perhaps? Perchance mayest thou be happy? I don't know. I think what he meant was to say the words clearly, to say them distinctly, and to say them meaningfully, to put your heart into it. Yeah. So this is not, don't let the words become just like a meaningless muttering that's just going along. Okay? You really want it, when we begin the meditation, we begin by actually making sure that we really wish ourselves to be happy and making sure like that the sound of the words inside our own mind is strong and clear. Okay? What this is doing, each step of this meditation, we'll talk more about this later on, but each step of this meditation is laying the groundwork in a very specific way for the development of samadhi. Right? So we are building the factors of samadhi one by one through the meditation. And the more care and attention we take at each stage of the meditation, then the better the results will be later on. So don't be in a hurry. Just saying to yourself the words over and over and over again. This, if this is all you can do, you're already fulfilling the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right intention. Thank you. Somebody remembered. Okay. And the one before that was what? Right view. Excellent. Thank you. Yes, so you're fulfilling right intention. And as long as you're thinking those thoughts with your meaning and your awareness with it, then you're not thinking anything bad. You're not thinking any hateful thoughts. You're not thinking any cruel thoughts. So you can just keep on just thinking those thoughts forever and no harm will come of it. Yeah? Now, this is only the beginning of the meditation. And metta is not a thought. Right? We're going to go deeper than that. We're going to go beyond the thoughts. But what this is doing is directing our mind in a certain way. And it's laying the groundwork. So don't neglect it and don't be in too much of a hurry. Each step of the way, pay your fullest attention to developing that step. So may I be happy. May I be happy. You're keeping your mind focused inside your heart, inside your body. Okay. So for this whole meditation, you're always keeping your awareness inside your body, not letting it go outside. Why? Because then your concentration becomes diffused, your mind becomes diffused. So keep your awareness inside your body. Again, this is one of the reasons why we begin with the mindful awareness. So the mindful awareness helps us to realize where our body is. Not as obvious as you might think. Like a lot of us, I think James Joyce wrote, he said, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body, which is where a lot of us live a lot of the time. Yeah. So we're getting grounded and we're getting that kind of solid basis of awareness in our body. One of the things that we'll find is that the experience of our body is transforming during the course of the meditation. What we think is our physical body, our physical frame, turns out to be something quite different. So as we're continuing with the words of metta, we're continuing with the meaning of those words, and we're continuing to remind ourselves of that. That can go on for as long as it likes. And if that's the rest of your retreat, that's fine, okay? Just that is practicing the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, and you're doing really well. But at some point, a point that we cannot really anticipate or predict or control, at some point, that feeling of metta will come up. And it will appear to you inside your body as a real sensation. It will feel warm and joyful and soothing and pleasant. It may come in any part of your body, or it may come through your whole body. It may come just in a flash and then go, or it may come very, very slowly. It may be very subtle, maybe very obvious. Don't worry about any of those things. When that feeling starts to arise, then what you want to try to do, this is where the delicacy of your attention is really important. When the feeling of metta comes, what you want to do is to try to just hold it in your mind. Right? So you're just watching it very, very gently, a bit like you're walking through the forest and you see a little bird on the branch, and you want, oh, the bird is so sweet. And you don't want to disturb it, so you just slow down and just watch very carefully. So you just try to watch very carefully, very lovingly, that feeling. Now, when you're developing the meditation, that feeling will be as unpredictable as a little bird in the forest. You know, it may just fly away or come back, who knows. But over time, as you do this again and again, that it's almost like that feeling learns to trust you. The more delicately that you can pay attention to it, that feeling, it's almost like the feeling learns that you don't mean it any harm, that you respect it, and that you're going to look after it. And so you can gradually learn to hold that feeling, and it sort of manifests inside you like a warm glow of light. And you keep on just holding that with the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. As long as you can, or as long as you like. Now when that feeling becomes well established, then you can try very softly moving your mind around your body. So you start just moving your mind, scanning through your body, and that feeling goes with it. Okay? So you're just gently scanning around your body. Yeah? And you're moving the feeling around. It doesn't really matter where the feeling comes, but ultimately it should be soaking through your whole body. Sometimes you'll have like parts of your body that maybe the feeling of metta doesn't really like. Maybe you're like holding some anxiety somewhere, or you've got like a pain in your back or something like that. So when it comes to places like that, don't worry about them too much. If you start to sort of niggle at those places too much, then it will destroy or tend to kind of wear down your metta at that point. So just kind of, oh, okay, I know you're there. I know that pit in my stomach is there, and that regret is there, or that whatever it is there. But I'm just going to kind of ease around you for the moment. Yeah? And I'm going to do the easy bits first. Yeah? And often enough, what you find is that when you do those easy bits and the body is mostly filled with metta, that those other bits will fill up just by themselves. So don't pay too much attention to those bits that are resisting the metta. Now, during this process, obviously, your mind is just as skittish and undisciplined as it is in any other form of meditation. And you probably are off thinking about this and that and all of those kinds of things. Okay? Again, don't worry about those things. That's not your meditation. Yeah? Thoughts are not your meditation. there's different moods or there's different memories or there's different things. That's not your meditation. The metta is your meditation. You need to be very, very clear about that. Those other things don't matter. Yeah, let them go. It's all right. Just keep coming back to the metta. And the longer that you go, the more you find that that feeling of metta will fill your mind and fill your heart. And all of those other things will tend to quieten down gradually. So this is how to practice the first stage of metta meditation. Okay, so what I'll do is for today, I'll introduce the second stage of metta meditation, which is metta for the loved person, okay? So I'm going to talk about this and about how to do this in the meditation. Now, some of you, look, honestly, when we're teaching it on this retreat, we're going way too fast, okay? And I just want to put this right up front. If you want to just do metta for yourself for the next year, good on you, okay? Don't be in a hurry. It's fine, okay? It doesn't matter. Just take your time. So during this retreat, we're going to go through the spectrum of the meditation, and the reason for doing that is because hopefully some of you will go through that spectrum. If not now, then at some point in the future. So we're going to be teaching you that whole thing, and you know, you'll probably be, you know, maybe stepping out in front of where you really should be going, but that's okay. At least you get an idea of where it's heading. So we've been doing metta for ourselves. Some people have been getting good response from that, some people not so much, and that's very natural for how this meditation goes. Now, I mentioned yesterday that we're doing metta for four people: oneself, a loved person, a neutral person, and a disliked person. So this is the four quadrants of this meditation. For today, we'll be doing metta for the loved person, okay? Now, generally speaking, to do metta for the loved person is not difficult, and it's not very different from what you've been doing already. And so I'm just going to give you like a few little bits and pieces of tips that's going to give you an idea of where this meditation's going. So if you recall the course of the meditation so far, as we establish the mind on the words of meditation, may I be happy, and we pay attention to the clarity and distinctness and steadiness with which we say these words, and then through those words we gradually become in contact with the feeling of metta, which arises as a result of the purity and integrity of our wish for our own true happiness. And that feeling of metta is a feeling which is part of our ordinary who we are, just an ordinary emotional spectrum. But we are identifying that and lifting it up and focusing on that. Now, once that feeling is present and once it's reasonably stable, then we can spread that through the whole body, gently moving the mind through the body and taking that feeling of metta through the body until you feel like your whole body is saturated with that loving kindness. And then once we can do that, then we maintain that for as long as we can. Ideally, if we can maintain that for 10, 20, 30 minutes when we're practicing, something like that. So this is a slow process. You know, take your time. Don't be like forcing yourself, oh, I've got to sit for this amount of time or that amount of time. But just like be able to assess, like there's a difference between like having a pleasant feeling that comes over you and having the feeling of metta which you can actually develop and maintain and hold. This is what we're after. We're after something that's going to be really steady and stable. That's what the meditation is building towards. So as we keep on going. Now when we can do that, this is the technical term as used in Ajahn Mahachachai's system. He calls this what they call the Uggaha Nimitta, or the preliminary Nimitta, preliminary sign, and I'm going to talk about that for just a minute. Now, many of you may have heard people in meditation talking about Nimittas. If you're familiar with Ajahn Brahm's teaching, he talks about Nimittas all the time. And typically, if you are doing breath meditation, for most people, the breath Nimitta appears as a light. So that's what people think of when you're doing meditation, you're seeing a light. In fact, the word nimitta doesn't mean light. Nimitta just means a sign. And so nimitta can actually appear in any way, really. It can appear in any different kind of form. So what a nimitta is literally a sign. Okay? A nimitta is a sign. It is a sign that your mind tells you to let you know that you are on the right path. It's literally what it is. You're driving on your way here and you pass the sign that says this is where you're going. Oh, now I know I'm on my right the path. That's what a nimitta is, quite literally. It's the way that the mind describes itself to itself. Yeah. So because it's the way that the mind describes itself to itself, it can be anything. But typically, it uses the light, which is the metaphor for knowledge, for clarity, and so on. In metta meditation, the nimitta is a feeling. In fact, the feeling of metta itself. Okay, so it's that feeling which is full of bliss and happiness, which has the same role as the light does in the breath meditation. So I'm not going to be discussing the breath nimitta and the light nimitta in this retreat, but they're basically the same, except for the way that you see it, the manner in which you're aware of it. In fact, the light nimitta also comes with the feeling, and the feeling nimitta also comes with the light. They're really just two sides of the same thing. But in the metta nimitta, the feeling tends to be prominent most of the time. Okay. So why do we call it a nimitta, or how do you identify it's a nimitta? With that preliminary sign that we're talking about right now, the basic thing that happens is that you feel that your mind comes together and that it's mostly settled around that feeling, which is mostly steady, right? We're not talking about like a super deep state of concentration or samadhi or anything at the moment. We're talking about the mind feels collected. Perhaps you could think about it in terms that, like before, you felt that you were kind of struggling with the meditation and mostly distracted and hindrances and so on, and only a little bit actually with the meditation, whereas now you've kind of crossed a line so that you're like mostly with the meditation and mostly everything has come together and mostly everything's working as it should, and only from time to time are you more distracted. Yeah, so that's kind of what this nimitta is. And obviously, that's a fairly loose description. We're not talking about a particularly sharply defined phenomenon here. But you will learn to recognize it as you practice. Right? So again, how Ajahn Mahachachai would talk about the metta nimitta is that the feeling of metta is present, it's clear, it's steady, and it pervades through your whole body for a period of at least 10, 20, or 30 minutes. If your energy is good, just keep going. Doesn't matter how long you go. You can keep going forever. Doesn't matter. So this is the nimitta. This is the sign that your samadhi is starting to come together. So fantastic. Excellent. If you reach that stage and you feel like that's going well, you can just pack up and go home if you want. Pat yourself on the back. Congratulations. You're doing really well. And if that's all that you ever, if meditation goes in your whole life, I don't know, it's pretty good. And it feels so lovely and you feel so refreshed and your body will feel at ease and your mind will feel at ease. And all of those like stresses and worries and anxieties that you have, it's not that they're gone, but they're not overwhelming you in the same way. You realize that within you have a place where you don't have to be dominated by those things. There is something inside you that is the place of freedom from those things. So it's a very powerful and very beautiful state of meditation. But we're only getting started. So once you get to that stage, and like I said, we're going to be accelerating a bit fast through the meditations in the teaching, but ideally, once you get to that stage, then you're ready to do the second person in meditation, which is the loved person. Now, basically, what you do when you do metta for that loved person is you don't change anything. You keep going exactly as you have been doing, and you just introduce the name of that loved person into the words of metta. So instead of saying, may I be happy, then perhaps you're doing metta for your father. So you might say, may my father be happy, or whoever it is that you've chosen for your loved person. That's it. That's all you do, okay? So you don't send your mind over there and try to like beam metta to them. Gotcha. Okay. You don't like think about all the nice times that you've had together and all the kind things that they've done, right? No, don't worry about any of those things. Your mind at this point is already strong. It's already clear. And all you're needing to do is to just remind yourself of that idea of that person. And that person's name is already enough to conjure up those kinds of emotional reactions that you need. Okay? Now, often people will ask, if you do this metta for other people like this, do they feel it? What do you think? Yes? You think they do? No. You think they don't? Who thinks they do or don't? You think they do? Who thinks they don't? Okay, very good. Well, what I can say to that is that all of those responses are very unscientific. What you should be doing is systematically developing metta for Aunt Sally at 7 p.m. without telling her, and then give her a call and say, "Hey, Aunt Sally, how's it going?" "Yeah, oh, good, that's nice. Yeah. So how are you feeling around 7 p.m. this evening?" Yeah. And we can test these things. Actually, there are ways of testing these kinds of responses. And you could do the same thing with your pets, right? Yeah, you could actually set up a scientific experiment. For example, you could say, let's say you have a dog in your house. You could say, "I'm going to go and sit meditation, right? And I'm going to do breath meditation, right? And I'm going to make a record of how many times the dog comes into my room to sit with me when I'm doing breath meditation. And then I'm going to do metta meditation for my dog. And I'm going to make a record of how many times the dog comes and sits with me when I do that." Yeah? That'd be good, wouldn't it? Yeah? So then you can find out for yourself. Yeah. So there are ways of testing these things. So if you're interested, I think this is an open question. My own belief is that, and this is not a particularly scientific belief or even a particularly Buddhist belief, but I think that we are less kind of cut off from each other, less kind of unified than we like to imagine. That we're more like kind of nodes of energy which kind of blurs off into the distance a little bit. And so we do kind of influence each other in different kinds of ways. And I think in meditation, then that can enhance both our sensitivity to others, but also the way that we affect others. But that's just my personal belief. Anyhow, so we're doing the metta, and we're doing the metta for that person who's a loved person. And there are a few words of advice that the ancients have passed down to us about who is a good person to develop metta for the loved person, okay? A few tips here, okay? Number one, don't develop metta for somebody who you are sexually attracted to, okay? For obvious reasons. So in in some of the Buddhist societies that I've been to, especially in KL and in Singapore, then I learned that there's a, maybe you might know more about this than I, but I learned that some people confessed to me that the boys were doing metta for the girls and the girls were doing metta for the boys, and that was how they arranged to meet people. Was that your experience? You've been at the youth group. You don't know about that? You don't know about that? May was at the youth group in Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. So you would know, would you? That's maybe just a rumor that I heard. Maybe you're hanging out with the wrong crowd, I don't know. So, I mean, and I've got to say that's not a particularly good way of developing meditation, but it's not a bad way of meeting somebody. I mean, anyway, moving on. So if you think of somebody who you're sexually attracted to, then obviously you can have feelings of lust arise, which can then interfere with your meditation. So that's not recommended. Then also don't include in your metta meditation somebody who has passed away, like any of your relatives who have died, okay? Because if you, it is believed that, like if you do metta for maybe Aunt Sally has died a few years ago, and you're doing metta for Aunt Sally, and Aunt Sally, maybe she's like sensitive to you doing that, and she comes to visit you from the other realm while you're meditating, and that could be disturbing. Or, for those of you who don't believe in ghosts, also the feeling of metta might be disturbed, because then grief can arise. Yeah? And you have that sense of grief and that sense of loss that can arise when somebody that you love has departed. So again, that is a recommendation. So generally speaking, metta is a very simple emotion. The simplest of emotions. It's childlike and pure. It's not complicated. It's not cynical, you know. And I remember one time I was teaching at the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, and one of the things I said was, you know, don't do metta for somebody who you have a dark and twisted love-hate relationship with. And there was this couple in the front row that immediately looked at each other like this. I was like, oh, that's so sweet. These guys are like, they're really self-aware, you know. They know exactly what's going on. I thought that was really sweet. So keep it simple, okay? This is not a place for you to solve your, you know, relationships or to sort things out or to heal yourself or anything like that. This is a place for you to experience metta. And we're trying to do that the easiest way you can. Now, of course, it's the case that we would hope that once, you know, when you come out of the metta meditation and you're going to have more love and more respect and so on for those people around you. And I think it's also important to notice that meditation, okay, what we experience in meditation doesn't have a determined relationship to what we do outside of meditation. Right? It's not fixed. It's not necessarily the case that you're going to do metta and that therefore you're going to come out of that meditation and be more loving to people. Right? That's not fixed. That depends on what you do when you come out of your meditation and you deal with people. Because your mind is messed up and all kinds of things can happen. And it's very easy, and in fact it happens all the time, that people will go into meditation, they'll have a nice meditation, and then they'll be like, oh, I'm the one who has metta. Oh, I had a nice metta meditation. I have metta. I am the one who has metta. And the conceit comes in. And because the conceit comes in and you identify, I'm the one who has metta, therefore if you're in a conflict with somebody, they must be the one who doesn't. They must be in the wrong, because I'm the one who's right, because after all, I know I had metta, right? So these are the kinds of ways that our defilements and conceit and so on can come and twist even those pure and good experiences. So what I'm saying here is that when we're thinking about how meditation affects us outside of meditation, that depends on what we do. We have to consciously take those things we've learned from meditation and make sure that we apply that in our relationships with others, yeah? Rather than thinking that somehow it's just going to automatically, magically manifest. It doesn't work like that. Right? There's a term that the psychologist Ken Wilberby uses for this. He calls it relatively independent. So these different spheres of our life are relatively independent, not totally independent, but also they don't have like a fixed or determined relationship. Okay, so back to metta for the loved person. So we're going to choose someone for the loved person who is going to be easy for us to love, somebody for whom we have a very simple and uncomplicated love for. Now, Ajahn Chacchai in his system recommends doing metta for people rather than for animals. So I don't think it's like a hard and fast rule. If you want to do metta for animals, I think that's fine. But generally speaking, we do metta for another person. And I think the reason for that is, again, that like it's all very gradual. Like another person, we're starting with metta for ourselves. Another person is more like us, you know? So you feel that more sense of that connection. Often, it's better to choose someone for the loved person who one not necessarily is the person that you love the most, right? The person that you love the most is often complicated, Yeah, maybe your partner or even your parents or something like that. Not always, but often that can be the case. So maybe it's someone who is a little bit more distant, like maybe your grandparents, or it could be even like a teacher or a good friend or something like that. So you just have to see for yourself who's going to be a good person. But somebody, not necessarily someone you love the most, but somebody you love the simplest. Yeah? So somebody you have that simple, uncomplicated love for. Okay, so, and again, that doesn't mean that it has to be perfect, right? Because everybody is annoying sometimes. That's just how it is, right? But just generally speaking, somebody who, when you think about them, you have those positive feelings for. So we do the meditation on oneself. You develop the feeling of metta, spread it through your body, maintain it for a good period of time, and then you introduce the words of that love, the name of that loved person, into the words of metta. Now, when you do that, the change there is very subtle, and that's the point. We're just changing one thing, not changing a whole bunch of things, just one thing. Your mind is still immersed in your body. Everything is the same, just the name has been changed. And then you can see how that affects your experience of metta. Sometimes, maybe the feeling of metta will fade away. Maybe sometimes it might evoke some memory or thought or response of that person. Maybe that will distract you. Or maybe it'll be much stronger. Maybe you do metta for the loved person and suddenly the metta fires up and it's much stronger than it was before. So this is what we're learning through doing this process. Right? We're learning that our metta for these different people is different. And that is ultimately what we're aiming to overcome. We're aiming to be in this place where the metta that we have for everyone, for literally every being in the world, is the same. Yeah? That's the outcome of this meditation. And this is our first step towards developing that. How is a metta for a loved person different from the metta for oneself? Yeah? And so we keep on doing this backwards and forwards. You can go, well, generally speaking, you develop metta for yourself, then metta for the loved person. If, in that second stage, if the metta falls away, right, then come back to metta for yourself. Develop it again and then go back. So you can do that as many times as you like. If the other thing happens, if you do metta for the loved person and then that it becomes stronger, then you do the opposite. Then you come back to yourself and you try to develop metta for yourself until it's just as strong as it is for the loved person. Yeah? So you can go back and forth between these until they're equalized. This is the aim. The metta for oneself and metta for the loved person shouldn't really be much different. That's where we're aiming for. Of course, that will vary and that will change over time. Right? It's not just an either-or situation, but that's generally what we're aiming for. If you find that when you do metta for yourself, that nothing happens, and then you do metta for a loved person, and then you feel that strong metta, it's okay to swap the order around. Begin with metta for a loved person, and then do metta for yourself. Okay, but in either case, then make sure that we develop it so that both of those are fully developed. Sometimes people use various kinds of hacks to get the feeling of metta going. So you might like have a nice picture of some puppies or something like that, or you can do something that's going to make you go, oh, that's so sweet, and then you have the feeling of metta going on. Personally, I don't emphasize doing those things too much. Like, if you want to do those things, fine, right? If there's something that makes you feel metta, that's very personal, memory or a thought or an image or something, that's not a problem. But my reservation is that those things tend to be a bit of a sugar high, and they don't tend to be like really repeatable or lasting. And then if it doesn't work anymore, then you're like, oh, what's the next hack? And so you're going around constantly looking for hacks rather than actually just developing your meditation. So just be patient, all right? Just take your time. Don't worry about it. The metta is there. Yeah? And if it's something that helps you to spark that metta, some memory or some thought or some idea, that's okay. But always come back to focus on what are the fundamentals of the meditation. That's what really matters. That's what will lead your mind to samadhi. And so today we're going to go to the third stage, which is loving kindness for a neutral person. And as I mentioned yesterday, we're going too fast. I'm well aware of that. So don't worry about it, okay? I'm not expecting you to, necessarily keep up or anything, but it's more just about like checking out what these different stages are like, really. If you want to just keep meditating, doing metta for yourself or metta for yourself and a loved person, honestly, that's probably best. But we'll just go through the different stages so that you know what they are. And of course, through the interviews and you hear people's different responses to the meditation, and some people getting really powerful responses and some people getting nothing, reaping, as the Buddha would say, reaping nothing but weariness and frustration, which is fine, okay? Just be patient. The Buddha gave a simile of the chicken sitting on the eggs. So when the chicken is sitting on the eggs, if she wishes, may these eggs hatch and be healthy, doesn't really make any difference. All that matters is she keeps on sitting. So don't worry about what you think too much. Don't worry about is this working or anything, particularly for the period of the retreat, okay? At the end of the retreat, maybe you want to look back and assess and say, look, is this practice for me? Do I want to keep that going? But for now, just throw yourself into it. I guarantee you that's the best way to do it. If you don't get anywhere, it's all right, you learn something. Yeah. This is science, right? It's how science works. You get just as much information from a negative result as you do from a positive result. Maybe not as exciting, but still you can learn. Okay, so today we're going to do metta for the neutral person. But before I go on to talk about that, I'm just going to mention a couple of things which have come up in the meditation and just to go over those. One was that when doing different meditation methods, and I don't recommend mixing different meditation methods in the same sitting, okay? So if you want to change meditations, that's fine, get up and then come back and start a second sitting. But I do recommend to keep doing the meditation that you have already been doing. So don't like completely stop doing the practice you've done in the past. Keep doing it and then do some metta meditation as well, all right? And do like a few sittings each day of each practice. Don't think that it has to be sort of either one or the other. Actually, it's very helpful to learn different practices. Just bear in mind that each practice is distinct and try to remember to preserve the integrity of each practice when you're doing it. When you have mastered those things, you can do what you like. Okay, you don't have to worry about any of that. But when you're learning, just sort of keep the method as it is as much as you can. I'm going to talk about doing metta for the neutral person. Okay, so doing metta for oneself and doing metta for the loved person, these generally speaking are the easier stages, so they generally speaking go okay. And from speaking to people in the interviews, most people seem to be doing that just fine. So that's good. And my definition of just fine might be different from yours. Like you might be thinking, I'm getting nowhere with it. But to me, that's just fine because you're persevering. So don't worry about it. Okay, so just keep going. Some people have been afflicted with blind rage when trying to do this practice, which also is an interesting reaction. So the human mind is complicated. And we should be aware of the uncertainties of anything like this. So now we're going to go to the neutral person. Now, unlike oneself, typically with oneself, there's one of you, right? Right? Unless we have anyone with split personalities or something. So that's good. We've got one person. And with loved people, there's a few, typically. But with neutral people, there's a lot. Right, there's like 9 billion or so. So how are we going to choose which neutral person that we're going to think of in the metta meditation? Well, use a few basic criteria. Number one, the neutral person doesn't have to be somebody who's like completely and totally neutral in every way, okay? Just someone you don't have any particular strong feelings for one way or the other, all right? Same rules apply as for the love person. Don't choose somebody who you might be sexually attracted to or somebody who's passed away. Right, yes, neutral person. So it doesn't have to be like complete, just somebody who generally you don't have strong feelings about. It should be somebody that you know, all right? And it should be somebody that you know their name, right? Not just some rando walking down the street, okay? Because you have to have a clear idea in your mind about that person. Now, particularly with the neutral person, okay, each of these stages of metta has a kind of a particular kind of downfall that you can fall into, all right, when it goes wrong. So with metta for yourself, right, so the flip side of that, where that goes wrong, is into narcissism. Right? If you just have metta for yourself and it's not leavened by anything else, then it can become narcissistic. Love for a beloved person, right? Then that can turn into desire and attachment. Yeah? Even maybe it's not sexual desire or anything like that, but it can still be some form of attachment or something like that for that person. Maybe you know, you start to sort of flip over and you're thinking about, oh, like what that person can do for you. Right? Rather than that purity of that metta. And third person, the neutral person, also has a flip side, which is delusion. Yeah, it might, because the third person, neutral person, we don't really care about them. And so they don't actually provoke any feelings in us, so we can easily just not pay attention. So at this stage in the meditation, it's quite common that what will happen is that your mind might just drift because you're actually not really interested in that person, or your mind might lose energy. Yeah, same thing. You don't have an interest in the meditation, so your mind gets bored and the energy drops. All right. So these are some of the problems that you can encounter in this kind of meditation. And in fact, you probably will encounter them. Right? This is normal that these things will happen at this stage of the meditation. So we choose that third person. Don't choose a third person who is like a bad person or somebody who is messed up or something like that. So choose like a sort of fairly, you know, basically bland, normal kind of person. Yeah, because you tend to take on the characteristics that they have. So if you choose, say, a very delusional person for that, then you tend to absorb their characteristics. So just like an ordinary person, so it could be somebody at your work, so it could be somebody in your neighborhood, it could be someone on the meditation retreat, yeah? Someone at your local Buddhist center or something like that. Somebody who you know well enough to say hi and you know their names, but maybe you're not really close friends or you don't have any other kind of feelings about them one way or the other, okay? Because the counterpart of this meditation is delusion, right, with neutral feeling and delusion, then we want to be very clear when we start it that we have enough energy and enough focus in the mind, okay? But when you're practicing it, keep practicing metta for yourself and the loved person until you feel that that is like really good. Like you feel the metta for yourself is nice and strong, for the love person nice and strong, and you have a lot of clarity and energy in your mind. And when you feel good and clear like that, then you can say, okay, let's try doing metta for the third person, okay, for a neutral person. But if you feel like you're kind of starting to lose energy a bit, starting to lose focus a bit or something like that, then don't go to the third, to the neutral person. I mean, you can if you want, but most likely it'll just kind of vague out and your meditation will fall apart. It's not going to really hurt. The only thing that can happen if you do that is that you can fall into what in meditation circles they call bhavanga. So bhavanga is basically a state where it's very peaceful, but your awareness has kind of slipped kind of below the threshold. So you're not like quite asleep as such or quite awake, and your mind is very still, and you can stay in that state for quite a long time, and you can even tell yourself that you're in a state of samadhi. Right? You can come along, you can sit and say, wow, nothing happened for the last hour. Right? I must have been in jhanas. It's great. And if you get into that mindset, which some people do, then you can keep on doing that again and again for years, thinking that you're practicing some deep meditation. So this is what they call bhavanga. So, of course, the tell is that a real state of samadhi is incredibly bright and your mindfulness is incredibly sharp and your awareness is incredibly sharp and not dull and grey. So if that happens, and it's normal that that happens, it'll happen to pretty much every meditator at one point or another. You'll be meditating along, everything's going great, mind's becoming a little bit tired and so on, and then it just kind of slips down below the threshold of consciousness, and your mind sort of goes in that subliminal half-awake state for a while. So if that happens, then afterwards you reflect back and you say, oh yeah, that's what happened. Yeah? So you recognize it and you know better next time. So like I said, it's not really a problem as long as you don't let it become a habit. Yeah. Some people here have told me that they really don't like doing metta meditation. They hate love. I love that. I think it's fantastic. I think we need more people in the world who hate love. Everyone loves love. It's boring. It's like a bunch of sheep. Everyone thinks love is such a good thing, okay? So I think it's great that we have this diversity of humanity and that some people think love is challenging and difficult. I think it's fantastic. Actually, it's really interesting because it's actually very true, because love is a very challenging emotion. And yeah, we had this idea, of course everybody knows it's a good idea, but the reality is that the reason why it seems rare is because it actually is a challenging and difficult thing that leaves you open, leaves you vulnerable, and it requires a lot of surrender and a lot of things. So it is actually, it's not as straightforward as we like to imagine it is. So if you're not enjoying or not doing the metta meditation, I think that's fine. We do something else. But the only thing that I would say is don't close yourself off to the possibility, because all of us are growing and changing even as we're sitting here. No matter what you think, no matter you might say, I've been doing this for 10 years, I've been doing this for 20 years or whatever, that's 10 years, that's the past. Right? That doesn't determine the future. All of that time, every time that you're meditating, you are changing. Right? And you changed this morning when you did that meditation. You learned something about yourself and you learned something about how these meditations go. So don't see that as being like a failure or being a problem. Ah, that's interesting. You know, my mind responded in these different ways to these different meditations. Ah, now I've learned something. Yeah? This is good. Yeah. So when we're doing the metta meditation, my advice, and I know other teachers teach to connect your metta with your breath or whatever, that's fine, you want to do that, do that. But my recommendation is to not do that, and certainly that's in the suttas is the case. There's nothing in the suttas about combining these different meditations or anything like that. So with metta meditation, we are committed to that. We're committed to developing metta to the deepest level possible. And where that starts to get very exciting is when we're starting to do metta for the disliked person. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So that's going to be fun, all right? So we've done metta for oneself. Nice. We've done metta for a loved person. Okay. We've done metta for a neutral person. Okay. Let's just assume hypothetically that that all went great. Okay. And here we are. We've done metta for a neutral person. Body is filled with metta, filled with love, and you feel like the solidity of that, like it is like gelled into a kind of a firm, but very soft and very stable feeling of metta. And then you think you want to develop metta for a disliked person. So what happens then? Well, basically, it's the same as what we've done with the previous two people. So you think of a person who you don't like, and then you just put the name into the words of metta when the appropriate time comes. So the basic method is exactly the same. It doesn't differ at all. But, of course, what happens is that at this point is that you're really starting to test your mind. And like we mentioned a few minutes ago about how this meditation is really good because it shows you exactly what is working and what is not working. And so if you start developing metta for a disliked person and you're not ready to do that, then you quite possibly will just like really, really hate that person. It's quite likely. Or your mind will just lose its metta right away. Or any kind of things that will happen. It's quite a dicey situation, actually. Up to now, it's been pretty much not a problem, and the only main real risk that you're going to have so far is, as we talked about, that you do metta for a neutral person and you might get sleepy and lose your energy. That's about the worst that can happen for most people. But with metta for a disliked person, you can really slip into anger very strongly. Why? Because your mind is very, very focused on that one thing. Yeah? And if you lose your mindfulness and you slip, then that can flip over to the other side very quickly. So we have to be very careful when doing this. Now, what kind of disliked person should we choose? The most hated person in the world? Well, we're not going to name any names. Sorry? Sorry? Just for example. Look, okay. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Look, I'm just... Sorry? Yes, that's right. Yeah, group hate, yeah. Definitely not recommended. But just a bit of a shout-out for poor old politicians. Like, politicians get a lot of crap from people, and I know that they often deserve it. But... sort of small little kind of family anecdote. My sister used to work for a man called Jeff Gallop, who was the then premier of my state, Western Australia. And Jeff was a really lovely guy, very very intelligent. He was a Rhodes Scholar, very a lot of sincerity and integrity. And he was elected premier. And my sister was his chief policy officer and later on his speechwriter. And when she got her new job as his speechwriter, he was on holiday and she wrote him the first speech of when he was going to get back and he was going to give this speech. She wrote it and sent it to him. And then the message that she got that they got back in the office was, "Oh, I'm going to resign. I'm because of depression." And my sister was like, "Oh, I hope it wasn't that speech that I wrote. It wasn't that bad, was it?" But he resigned, and he was suffering from... He went away on holiday, and he realised that here he is, surrounded by everything's nice with his family and everything, and, yeah, something's badly wrong. And that was a kind of a very important moment in Australian political history, because I think it was the first time that a person in such a position of prominence had admitted that they'd been suffering from this mental illness. And he had been always a very good friend of ours, a good friend of the Buddhist Society. He opened the Jhana Grove Meditation Center, and he's a good friend of Ajahn Brahm and myself, and I still stay in touch with him, actually. Jeff came along to our... we did a launch for a book project for sort of Central earlier in the year, and Jeff kindly came along and gave a bit of a talk and a bit of a chat for that as well. So really nice guy. And he couldn't survive in politics. Ended up suffering from clinical depression because of all of the crap. Yeah? And I think it's really important to just bear that in mind. There are some people who can survive in that environment very easily. Those people are psychopaths and narcissists. And that's why they end up at the top of the heap so very often. Yeah, the political processes and leadership processes positively select for psychopathic qualities. And I'm not using that word kind of loosely. I mean, like, genuinely clinical psychopaths who end up running countries and do so all over the world. So while it is normal and important and healthy to joke about our politicians, and I know that probably Norway is one of the better countries in the world as far as this is concerned, but it's normal and healthy to joke about them. When we built our parliament house in Australia, in Canberra, The architect made sure to put a grassed field on the roof of the Parliament House so that the people could come and walk on top of their leaders. Yeah. It is important, but at the same time, it's also important to have compassion for people who are trying to do a job where they do actually have a genuine sense of civic service and are trying to do the right thing. If we give all politicians a hard time all the time, then good people are never going to go into that job. Okay, so that's just a bit of a rant on politics and leadership. Where was I? Metta, hated person. Best to choose somebody from your life. Now, it does not have to be like a deadly nemesis, okay? Now, that is such a sexist cliche. Mother-in-laws, generally speaking, are very nice. Anyway, yes, could be a mother-in-law. Thank you. Somebody in your life who you don't like, somebody you find annoying. Right, could be like a bully at work, or it could be just a neighbour who, you know, their taste in music is wrong, or could be doesn't have to be like a big thing. Right, it just can be just a small thing. In fact, it's probably better if it's just a small thing. Yeah. So as with the loved person, it's not necessarily the person that you love the most. Right, the person that you love the simplest is more important. Same thing with the disliked person. It's not necessarily the person you dislike the most, but the person you dislike the simplest. Yeah, you want to keep this very clean as possible. So before you start the meditation, then think of a person who you dislike. And then that's usually the easy part. The hard part, stop thinking about them. Okay? All right? Just stop, just don't do it, right? So at this point already, this is where you need that strong mindfulness. If you, before you're meditating, you're like, okay, I'll do a metta for a disliked person. Who is that? Oh, yeah, that's Gary. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, bloody hell, he still hasn't given me back that money he owes me, right? Tight bastard. And, you know, and as soon as you start proliferating like that, it's going to undermine your development of metta right from the beginning. So it's really important that you have that mindfulness to think of that person who you dislike and then stop thinking of them. Okay, this is really important. The purpose of this is not to analyze why you dislike them or all the things that are wrong about them and all the bad things that they've done to you. The purpose is not to heal the relationship that you have with that person. Right? Hopefully that can happen. Right? But that's not the purpose of the meditation. The purpose of the meditation is to overcome the hatred in our own heart. So remember that. So when we come through the meditation, metta for oneself or a loved person, neutral person, disliked person. Now, if things are going well, what will happen is something like this. All through this meditation, our samadhi and our mindfulness has been growing stronger. And that manifests as more stability of mind, more clarity of awareness, and it manifests in metta meditation as the persistence of that feeling of metta. And the longer that we're going on, the more that we are becoming immersed in that feeling of metta. That's the process of samadhi. So remember how I've talked from the beginning about how we feel that feeling of metta through our own body, okay? Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about what the body means in Buddhism and in Buddhist meditation. And this is an often controverted topic and I think is widely misunderstood by people who don't know how to read apart from anything else. But the body has a body. The body that we experience in meditation is not the same body that a doctor will look at. Okay? A doctor or someone outside will look and will see what that looks like from the outside. We experience our body from the inside. And that experience of the body that we have from the inside really has two dimensions. One dimension is from the direct experience of sense input, right? Sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, that we actually literally are experiencing these physical phenomena as we are sitting there. That's one dimension of the body. The other dimension of the body is the inner idea we have about our body, right? So we have a perception of our body. We have an inner mental image of what our body is. And it's because we have that inner mental image, that's how we can do things. It's how we can walk around without bumping into things. And it's how we can manage to actually coordinate our body. So this is a normal part of how the human mind works. So these two dimensions in Buddhism are called the Olarika Kaya and the Sukhama Kaya or Manomaya Kaya. And what happens when you... So they're both the body. When you're meditating, your awareness of that Olarika Kaya or the sense-stimulated body is gradually fading so that your perception of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch is fading away and you're becoming more deeply absorbed in that feeling of the Sukhama Kaya or the inner mental perception or representation of the body. Yeah, and so I know that sounds like a lot of fancy words and so on, but how you experience that in meditation is that as you go deeper in meditation, your hearing will tend to fade away. Yeah, that your sight maybe fade away. Like you might be sitting in meditation and your eyes can drift open. I don't know if this has happened to anybody, but this happens to me when I meditate. You close your eyes, you meditate, and as your mind becomes peaceful, your eyes actually start to drift open unconsciously, but you don't see anything. Yeah. If I'm in Australia, you're sitting there and the eyes drift open, you don't see anything until a kangaroo hops in front of you. And you're like, oh, okay. Is that really? So your senses are shutting down because you're not paying attention to them. And even in the physical senses, like all those feelings of pain or itches and all of those things, which were quite overwhelming at the start of the meditation, and these are all starting to recede. And the feeling of metta, which is manifesting through that subtle body or that representational body, that is becoming very, very apparent. So there's this kind of whole dialogue in Buddhist meditation about are you experiencing your body or not and blah, blah, blah. But a lot of that has just come from a misunderstanding of what the word body means. Actually, the body starts with the meaning of like this physical entity that we have here, but it also means something like the field of perception or the field of direct awareness. So as you go into the fourth stage of metta meditation, the property of one-pointedness, which I'll talk about more this evening, but the property of one-pointedness starts to become prominent. What that means is that your sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch really start to fade away, and you are only doing this one thing. Why? Because your mind knows, subconsciously, your mind knows that this is what I have to do. My task right now is to overcome hate. That's it. And all of that work you've done, all of that meditation you've done, all of that, I'm not saying you're thinking about this consciously. It happens purely through the subconscious. You focus like a razor on that one thing and everything else falls apart. And so when that happens, it's almost in some ways like the opposite of what happens with the neutral person. With the neutral person, because you don't care about them, then your mind becomes a bit lazy and can lose attention. With the disliked person, your mind becomes extremely energetic, extremely focused, and you're just like that one person and everything else is just fading away, fading away, fading away. And the mind becomes more and more and more and more energetic. Now, if your mindfulness lapses at that point, then especially if you start to think about that person, all right, then it can flip very quickly and you can lose everything. Yeah, and so that's usually how it goes, or sometimes that will how it goes. So you'll be going there doing metta for that hated person. You know, may Aunt Sally be happy, may Aunt Sally be happy. And then your mindfulness will slip a little bit and you say, oh, look, Aunt Sally, God, you know, Aunt Sally, she's really pretty good, isn't she? Oh, okay, Aunt Sally, may Aunt Sally be happy, may Aunt Sally be happy. All those times I disliked Aunt Sally, and you know, actually, she's actually a really nice person. May Aunt Sally be happy, may Aunt Sally. And it goes like that. And this is the voice of Mara, which is making you think about that person, conditioning you little bit by little bit to think that it's okay to have a thought about Aunt Sally instead of just doing the metta for her. And may Aunt Sally be happy, may Aunt Sally be happy. Oh, I think of that kind thing that Aunt Sally did on my birthday and she gave me a nice present. It's like, oh, may Aunt Sally, my Aunt Sally. Of course, you know, she's not perfect. Who is? May Aunt Sally, you know, be happy. God, she was really a bitch that day, wasn't she? May Aunt Sally be happy. And that's how that goes, right? So this is why it's really important for your mindfulness to stay very, very sharp at this point, okay? Don't let yourself drift into thinking about that person at all, okay? Don't. That's Mara tempting you, yeah? So keep that focus, keep that focus, keep that focus. And it's kind of weird at this point in the meditation. You're approaching like a transitional point in meditation. And in that kind of transitional point, on the one hand, like you are more peaceful than you've ever been. Your meditation is actually like really nice. You feel very blissful, very energetic. Everything's coming together and it feels great. On the other hand, it also feels very fragile. Because the very slightest thought can do it, or at this point, even like a loud sound or something can disturb your meditation very easily, right? So this is that kind of transitional point that you're in, and this point is always regarded in meditation traditions as being something that you should really take care of and make sure that you safeguard as best as you can. Okay, so that means that if you're meditating to be able to get to this point, try not to stop. Try to keep going, right? As long as you can. So don't worry, is everyone getting up to go, you know, for lunch or something like that? Don't worry, just stay meditating. If your meditation's going good, just keep going. Yeah? Don't worry about anything else. So when that continues, ultimately you reach a point that they call, Pali word is Sima Sambheda, which is the breaking down of the barriers. And again, I'll talk more about this evening, but the basic idea is that there's no longer any difference between oneself, a loved person, a neutral person, and a disliked person. So it's important to understand the sense in which that is true. What that doesn't mean is that you can think of those four different people and love them all. It doesn't mean you think of those four different people and you can't choose which one is better or not, okay? It means that that thing inside you, which might have distinguished between those four people, doesn't exist anymore. Like you don't have the capacity to even think in terms of like and dislike anymore. It's all just broken down. And the power of metta is so strong that those categories of like and dislike and neutral are simply wiped out of your mind. I mean, you still know that they exist, right? But they don't have any meaning for you anymore. And this is what we're really talking about when we're talking about transcending through the power of metta meditation. So this is the development of metta for the disliked person, okay? Now I've said, go on. I'll talk about that this evening, but yes, yeah. Once you're doing the metta for the disliked person and once you've transcended that, then yes, you're just about ready to let go of the words. Yeah, the words, like your experience of the body, your experience of the words are also kind of receding through this meditation. They're still there and they're still like reminding you just a little bit and focusing and directing you just a very little bit, but the feeling is becoming so much more strong that that's really the overwhelming focus of the meditation. Yeah. Okay.